Clint will take care of it, he said. This was my cue to enter the daydream with my neat dispatch case. In a later version I acquired red tabs, too. This embellishment made me laugh out loud until I almost choked, and an elderly man sitting on the train opposite asked if he should thump me on the back. For the rest of the journey I contented myself with dwelling pleasurably on the thought that while I was on my course in Holborn I was allowed to live at home. For years I had been a two-finger hunt and peck kind of typist, and I was quite proud of my speed. On the first day of the course I was annoyed to learn I had been doing it all wrong, and thenceforth I must use all my fingers and be a touch typist. They gave me a diagram of the typewriter keyboard to prop up in front of me, and dutifully I started to learn these new ways. Filing too had a lot more to it than I had ever suspected. It was by no means the simple matter of putting papers in a box in alphabetical order, which I had always supposed it was. There were drawers, sliding panels, tags of different colors, cards, folders, indexes, and the idiosyncratic negation ling of one simple letter was a nightmare operation in which, it seemed to me, the simple letter was lost forever. As for shorthand, I found the hieroglyphs baffling enough without the complications of heavy and light strokes, dots and dashes and all the rest. If it had not been for the happiness of living at home and the fact that I had my evenings and weekends to myself, I think I would have given up in despair of ever making sense of it all, but I soldiered on with the threat of the end of course final exam hanging over my head like the sword of Damocles. Our home circle had resumed its regular sittings now that I was at home, and one evening a woman's voice spoke in an agitated way, asking to speak to her son. We asked for her name and she said it was Clara Novlow Davis. One of the sitters remarked that she must be Ivan Novlow's mother. The woman in spirit said she was Ivan Novlow's mother and she was extremely anxious to speak to him. We explained that we did not know her son, but if there was some message she wanted to convey to him we would make every effort to see that he got it. The spirit thanked us for our offer but said she wanted to speak to her son personally because what she wanted to say was too private for any ears other his own. Naturally we wondered why Ivan Ovlo's mother sounded so distressed, but after she had gone we thought no more about it. Some weeks later an actor friend of mine asked me to give a séance at his flat because he was anxious to help one of his friends who had become interested in spiritualism. I agreed, and when I arrived at his flat on the evening we had arranged I was introduced to his friend, who turned out to be the enchanting actress Beatrice Lilly. Almost as soon as the lights were turned out Miss Lilly's son Robert, who had been lost on active service with the Navy, spoke to her and they had a happy reunion. When Robert had gone I was surprised to hear the voice of Clara Novlow Davis addressing Beatrice directly. She asked Miss Lilly to contact Ivor and arrange for him to sit with me so that she could talk to him about something very urgent. Miss Lilly asked Novlow's mother to say something which she could repeat to Ivor so that he would know it was really his mother who was speaking. The spirit said that Ivor had that moment entered his idiosyncratic negation at from Oxford, where he had been to visit a former teacher of his. As soon as the lights were turned on, B. Lilly telephoned Ivan Ovlow and told him all that had occurred at the sitting. She found that what his mother had said about his return from visiting a teacher in Oxford that evening was true, and Novlow showed a great deal of interest. It was arranged then and there over the phone that I should give him a sitting in his idiosyncratic negation at one night after his show The Dancing Years. On the night I was to give Ivan Ovlow his sitting I met my actor friend at the Ivy restaurant in London, where he had invited me out for dinner. Ivor was to meet us there after his show and we would go from there to his idiosyncratic negation at. While we were having our meal Ivor phoned us at the restaurant and he cancelled the arrangement. My friend and I were disappointed and also somewhat annoyed at being put off at such short notice without a very convincing excuse. My friend thought Ivor had probably had cold feet at the thought of speaking to spirits in his own idiosyncratic negationate and probably imagined it would be haunted thereafter. Some weeks later we read in the newspapers that Ivor was to be prosecuted for an offence in connection with petrol rationing. Apparently, he had been driving down to his country home at weekends using petrol vouchers, which some girl fan had acquired for him, without realizing he was committing, what was at that time, a criminal offense. Then it became clear to me why Clara Novlo Davis had made such efforts to contact her son. Obviously she wanted to warn him against accepting this illicit petrol. If Ivor had not cancelled his sitting with me at the last moment, it is possible he might have avoided the shame and misery he suffered when later he served a month in jail. I met Ivor Novlo some years after these events and he sat with me many times. Often his mother would come to speak to him. Ivor told me that once during his prison sentence he was sitting in his cell one evening feeling low and depressed and wondering if he could endure his sentence without a mental breakdown when his mother appeared to him. He said she looked as real and living as she had in life and the look of love and encouragement on her face gave him the strength to carry on and save his reason. I was in the theater on the night when Ivor gave his first performance of The Dancing Years after his release from prison and it was a night to remember. The whole house rose to applaud him and it went on and on until it seemed as though the audience would never let him go. It was a wonderful night and a great theatrical occasion, and it gave Ivor the assurance he needed that the past was behind him and he was still loved. Beatrice Lilly sat with me a number of times after her first sitting and once Rudolph Valentino came to speak to her. He mentioned their meeting in Hollywood and Miss Lilly asked him if he could remember the circumstances. Valentino said it was at a beach party at the home of Constance Dalmage and he spoke of a group photograph which was taken at the time, in which B. Lilly appeared and Valentino was sitting on a fence with his arm around his girlfriend Pola Negri. After this sitting Miss Lilly told me the beach party was the only time she had met Rudolph Valentino and the photograph he had described was at that moment in a trunk in her apartment in New York. My sword of Damocles inevitably descended and I sat the end of course examination designed to weed out those without the aptitude for office duties. I never did get the hang of their idiosyncratic negation ling system or master the hieroglyphs of shorthand and I still used my two-finger method on the typewriter in preference to the ten-finger exercise. Needless to say I was weeded out and the unlikely picture of me as an authority behind a general's desk vanished forever. While I was still licking my wounds I was told that men were urgently needed in the mines to ensure the nation's coal supply and too few volunteers were coming forward in response to appeals. Rashly I responded to these unsubtle hints and in no time at all I was sitting on a train on my way to Wolverhampton to train to become a miner. For some reason, which I am sure I was told at the time, it was not possible to remain in the army if you were a miner. So before setting out for Wolverhampton I had become a civilian again. What I failed to take into account when I let myself be talked into ensuring the nation's coal supply was the small matter of my claustrophobia. During the relatively short periods I had been enclosed in my cabinet for the public demonstrations of my mediumship I had regularly suffered from claustrophobia, to a greater or lesser degree, depending on the size of the cabinet and how airless it was. The symptoms were unpleasant but not so severe to seriously disconcert me and I had been able to put up with them for the duration of the seances. Foolishly I did not consider the possibility that working in the bowels of the earth for hours at a time would be likely to induce these symptoms, but a thousand times worse. During the training period I tried hard to control my feelings of being trapped and stifled and the unreasoning terrors which assailed me every time I descended to the coal face. But as the weeks dragged on it became more and more obvious I could never be a miner and every hour underground became an unspeakable torture. When I could stand it no longer I was returned with thanks to the army and posted forthwith to a big camp not far from Liverpool docks. Our work consisted of loading heavy crates of supplies for the forces overseas onto lorries for shipment abroad. Though the work was hard and exhausting and the camp seemed to be a special kind of target for night raids and daytime flying bombs, it was positive bliss after the horror of working in the mine and I remained there contentedly enough until day 10 in January 1946, a few days after my 35th birthday. I swapped my army uniform for the civilian outidiosyncratic negation T thoughtfully provided by a paternal government and I walked out of the demobilization center with a rail ticket for home and freedom in my pocket. As I opened the front door of 31 Sydney Grove with my key, Edith was coming out of the kitchen with a freshly made pot of tea in her hands. She was so excited to see me, she dumped the teapot on the polished top of the hall table and rushed into my arms. For years, the mark made by the scalding teapot remained to remind us of that reunion, and neither of us could ever bear to have the stain removed. Later that same day, Owen, who was now a flight lieutenant with the ribbon of the Distinguished Flying Cross on his tunic, turned up on leave unexpectedly, and the family was complete. In our house, happiness was always shared with friends, and we telephoned to invite several to celebrate with us. I went to the local wine store, but did not expect to find much, because supplies of wines and spirits had begun to dry up early in the war, and by this time they were in very short supply indeed. The keeper of the store was a man who had occasionally attended my group seances. Before I could even ask for a bottle of wine, with a flourish he produced a magnum of champagne. He told me it was the last of his stock and had kept it for the day I came home for good, and he would not allow me to pay for it. Later that night, when the toasts had been drunk and our friends had gone, under the overhead light I saw the new lines which the war had etched on Edith's face. Years of uncertainty, constant anxiety about Owen, and sleepless nights while bombs dropped around the house had taken their toll. She looked old and tired, but to me she had never seemed as beautiful. During a group séance held in 1940, my Cockney guide, Mickey, had introduced the spirit to the young airman. "There's a chap here from the Air Force," he said, "who wants to get in touch with his parents. He's so excited I don't know if he will manage to speak, but I'll try to help him." Then we heard the voice of the airman asking us to contact his father and mother. He had been to see them often, he said, but they could not see him. He told us he had been killed when his plane crashed over Norway. He was 20 years old and he was their only son. "Please tell mother I'm all right now," he urged. "She is so unhappy it's making her ill." No one in the group could identify this communicator, so Mr. Walter J. West, our vice president at the Temple of Light, asked the young man for his full name and address and promised to get in touch with his parents if it were possible to do so. "Thank you so much," replied the dead boy. "I had three first names, Peter William Hansford, and my surname was Kite, K-I-T-E, and I lived at 85 Uplands Way, Grange Park." Apostrophe. But that was not all. Peter Kite next spoke to a man in the group saying, "I know you, you're Mr. Turner, you took out my tooth." None of the other sitters knew that Mr. Turner was a dentist, nor did they know his name. Mr. Turner said he remembered Peter Kite coming to him for treatment some years before, but he did not know he had joined the RAF or that he had been killed. After the seance, Mr. West went to Grange Park and found the house where Peter Kite had said he would find his parents. Mr. West rang the doorbell and the dead boy's mother, Mrs. May Kite, answered the door. Mr. West explained his presence and from his notes relayed the details of Peter's comments made at the seance. Mrs. Kite acknowledged one point after the next, and after some conversation Mr. West promised to send Mrs. Kite a full transcript of the seance. Now that the war was over, I allowed myself a few days to get acclimatized to civilian life. Then the doors of the Temple of Light were opened again and I resumed the work I was born to do. At one seance were invited the parents of Flight Lieutenant Peter Kite and Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding, a convinced spiritualist, was our honored guest. Almost as soon as the light was turned off, Mickey came to tell us that Arthur Conan Doyle wanted to say a few words to Mr. and Mrs. Kite before their son came to speak to them. In his lifetime, Doyle had become convinced of spiritualism after years of sitting with mediums, and he spoke sympathetically to the parents, who had no real knowledge of psychic matters. He explained to them how, after Peter's plane had crashed, their son had found himself still alive, but in a new body, and this spiritual, more subtle body resembled, in every respect, his physical body which he had seen lying motionless in the wreckage of his aircraft. At first, the oil told the couple, their son had been bewildered because, although he could see the body which he recognized as himself, he felt so gloriously alive and well that he simply did not realize he was dead. When two local peasants came to investigate the wrecked aircraft, Peter was puzzled when they seemed unable to see or hear him, but then some friends of his, whom he knew to be already dead, had arrived and explained this new condition of life to him and took him to his new plane of existence. As soon as Conan Doyle had finished speaking, Peter Kite greeted his father and mother with excitement. "I've got the dog, Mother," he said laughingly. "It's an Alsatian." This was a reference to a joke he had played on his mother only a few days before his death. Peter had been fond of dogs and he had telephoned his mother to say he was sending home an Alsatian he had acquired. Mrs. Kite was not a dog lover and the thought of a huge Alsatian tearing around the house had appalled her. After teasing her for a while, Peter finally relented and reminded her that it was April Fool's Day. "I saw you putting my photograph in your bag with the ones from Norway before you left home," went on the spirit voice. Mrs. Kite told us she had changed her handbag before leaving for the seance and had transferred its contents, including her son's photograph and some, which had recently been sent to her, of his grave in Norway. "You are keeping the garden in good trim," said Peter. "I like the area you have turned into a garden of memories. Do you know that the birds nesting in the cherry tree can see me, even if you cannot?" His parents told us that when Peter had been killed 6 years earlier, they had turned a patch of their garden into a memorial to him and planted a cherry tree in which the birds had built their nests. "I often go to my room," Peter continued, "and you haven't changed a single thing in it. My model plane is still there and all my books and that wallpaper I didn't like." It was true that the parents had kept their son's room exactly as it had been on the day he was killed, and he had never cared for the wallpaper in it. "I'm glad my car is still going, but it's a bit small for you, Dad, isn't it?" Mr. Kite agreed that Peter's sports car fitted him a little too snugly. He was a large and somewhat overweight man. "I'm saying all these silly little things so you will know it's really me speaking and that I do come to see you. Above all, I want you and Mother to know I am alive, more alive now than I ever was." For almost 40 minutes the voice of Peter Kite went on providing evidential detail after detail, details that were trivial in themselves, but in combination they gave his parents incontrovertible proof of his identity and continued existence. When the seance was over, both parents declared their son's survival of death had been conclusively proved to them. "I had never thought very much about this kind of thing before," said Mr. Kite, "but now I am completely convinced." Mrs. Kite added, "I have found more comfort in this seance than from any other source since my son was killed, and I have lost a great deal of the bitterness I felt. During an occasion I was on leave from the army, I had given a sitting to Mrs. Marie Barrett, a Belgian lady living in Golders Green, whose son George had been killed on active service early in the war. George had manifested at her sitting and had given such undeniable proof of his survival that her grief had been assuaged and life for her had become worth living again. Mrs. Barrett was wealthy and she had a generous heart. As a sort of thank you and memorial to her son, she decided to give other mothers who had lost sons the opportunity to receive the comfort she had been given. Once I had returned home after my army service, Mrs. Barrett booked regular seances with me and would bring mothers from all over the country, their expenses being paid from a fund she had established for the purpose. Before each of her seances, Mrs. Barrett would tell the mothers that she had told the medium nothing whatsoever about any of them, not even their names, so that any evidence obtained might be the more valuable. Many touching reunions took place at these sittings and mothers went away comforted. On one occasion, one of Mrs. Barrett's mothers did not turn up on time for the start of the seance, and after we had waited for a few minutes we decided we must start without her. When the seance had been in progress for a while, a young man's voice was heard asking for his mother. Mrs. Barrett asked him who he was, and when he had given his name she realized he must be the son of the missing mother. Mrs. Barrett explained to the dead boy that his mother had not yet arrived and the seance was being held without her. "Mother's train was late," said the voice, "but she is here now. She is sitting on a chair on the landing outside this room. Please let me talk to her." Regretfully, Mrs. Barrett told the boy she could not open the door of the séance room to admit his mother in case the light from outside harmed the medium. "I must try to speak to her somehow," said the young man. "She grieves for me so incessantly it makes me very unhappy, and I can't settle down in my new life here." Then a wonderful thing happened. As a rule, the voices of the discarnate speak from a point above my head and slightly to one side of me, within what Mickey has referred to as my auric emanation, but as this spirit spoke, his voice moved right away from me across the room to the door, where he called loudly for his mother. From outside the door, the mother answered him, and the dead boy and the living mother talked together through the door until the woman was convinced he was really her own son, alive and loving as he was in life. At another group, it was a daughter who returned to comfort her mother. A Mrs. Mixon, who lived in Oxford, telephoned one afternoon, on impulse as she told me, and since there happens to be a vacant place in one of our groups, she was given the seat. Her daughter manifested and spoke of her career as a dancing teacher, in a clear girlish voice with a tinge of North Country accent. The girl reminded her mother of the last ballet they had seen together at Covent Garden, Les Sylphides, and told her that since her passing she had met the Russian prima ballerina Anna Pavlova, for whom she had always had the greatest respect and admiration. The daughter also spoke of a time when she had played truant from school years before and waited 3 hours in the snow for a seat in the gallery to see Pavlova dance at a matinee. Mickey was puzzled about the dress he said the girl was wearing. First he said it was a wedding dress, then he thought it might be a Catholic confirmation dress, but when he described some red flowers on the skirt, Mrs. Mixon recognized it at once as the long ballet dress that she herself had sewn red flowers onto before her daughter's last illness. "I have been given absolute proof of the survival of my daughter," wrote Mrs. Mixon in a letter to Psychic News after the séance. "I was a perfect stranger at the séance. I booked my seat by telephone from Oxford and I was alone. Most of those who communicate from the other side at my séances speak of how happy they are in their new condition of life, but I remember one entity who startled one of my groups by being very cranky and disgruntled. He told us he was an American soldier who had been killed in the London Blitz, and when a lady member of the group said she was surprised to hear him talk in that way, he replied, 'Well, it wasn't any fun to come all the way over to London just to die in an air raid.'" A direct voice séance normally has two restrictions imposed on it. One is that it must be held in absolute darkness. The other is that only a limited number of sitters may take part. Both before the war and during the war, when I was on leave, Noah Zerdin and his circle had been experimenting with a specially constructed cabinet in which I sat during séances in an effort to lift both these restrictions. Eventually, these experiments were so successful that it was decided to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the founding of the Link Association with a huge public séance in the Kingsway Hall, at which the hall would be fully lit and the audience would number more than 1,000 people. On the big night, Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowding introduced me to the audience and asked them to accept his personal assurance that no fraud would take place. The cabinet was about 7 feet high and 4 feet square and was placed in the center of the platform where everyone in the audience could see it. I think those seated at the extreme ends of the gallery could probably even see all around it. The four sides of the cabinet were covered with tarpaulin to ensure no light could enter, and I sat inside on an ordinary chair. In front of the cabinet, at a distance of 18 to 20 inches, stood a microphone, and the members of the Zerdin circle sat around it in the form of an ellipse with the cabinet as focal point. In these conditions, under the full glare of the hall's lighting, the huge audience was given a demonstration of independent, direct voice, comparable to those usually experienced by small groups sitting in privacy. Mickey's clear Cockney voice was the first to be heard that evening, and since it seems to be part of his function to put people at their ease before a séance, he raised a laugh by saying perkily, "Proper crowd air tonight, ain't there? I expect a lot of em don't know much about this kind of thing, but I'll do my best for em." And from then on he did indeed. The first visitor from the other side gave his name as Roy Markant and was acknowledged by his parents in the audience. "Hello, Mother. Hello, Dad," said Roy excitedly. "I want you to know I am not dead, I'm marvelously alive and I send all my love to you and to the baby. His parents replied affectionately. Then Roy thanked his mother for a children's party she had given for his child. Don't think of me as being a long way off, because I'm not, he went on. I am often with you. I was with you in Switzerland. There isn't any real separation. The next communicator gave her name as Gladys Richmond and spoke to a man at the front and was pleading to be forgiven for some misunderstanding between them when she was on Earth. I'm sorry about everything, she said. It was an accident. You do believe that, don't you? The man assured her he both believed and understood. I'm so happy you understand, said Gladys, and that you realize I love you and one day we will be together again. You often read that last letter I wrote to you before I went to Scotland. I have seen you reading it. I feel like an interloper, but I hope you won't mind, came the voice of a woman. I am Stella Patrick Campbell and I want to introduce Leslie Howard to you. There was a rustle of expectancy throughout the auditorium. Leslie Howard, the famous actor, had been killed 3 years before when his unarmed plane was shot down over the Bay of Biscay by a German fighter and his death had been widely mourned. A cultured masculine voice was heard. God bless you. I am happy to be able to come and speak to you in this way. Many of you do not perhaps understand fully that there is no death. Those of us over here who come in this way, come to guide and help you, to try to uplift you. Spirit guidance does not cease. That which happened 2,000 years ago has happened through the centuries and it is still happening today. I went to meetings like this when I was on Earth and I found great comfort and interest. I was not, perhaps, a spiritualist, but certainly I believed in man's survival of death. Speaking on a more personal note, the voice of Mr. Howard went on, I would like to speak to Phyllis James, my former secretary. Miss James answered him and he asked her to send his love to Ruth and to tell his family of his appearance that night. Death has not robbed me of any of my faculties, he concluded. God bless each one of you here tonight. One of the most touching contacts of the evening began very quietly with Mickey saying, I want to speak to the lady all in grey at the back because her boy is here. He was in the Navy. His name is Jim. A woman at the very back of the gallery called out, is it for me? The moment her voice was heard, suddenly and loudly came the pathetic cry, Mum. Mum, I'm so glad you've come. Darling, darling. Was all the mother could reply. I'm not dead, you know, Jim assured her anxiously, I'm all right. In his effort to bring conviction, Jim's anxiety increased. I wasn't drowned. I'm alive. This shouted word rang through the hall, fraught with the pain of not knowing whether the comfort he sought to bring would be fully understood. Mickey intervened at this point to provide the anti-climax which restored a smile to every face. Jim's a darn sight more alive than you are, lady, I'll tell you. When the seance was nearly over, a woman's voice was heard speaking in the cultured and precise diction that was so familiar to my own home circle. It was the voice of our friend Ellen Terry. Ladies and gentlemen, I was asked to come and speak here tonight for a few moments, though I know too well many have more proficiency than I. For all of you who have faith in the spirit and the surety of knowledge that life continues after death, there is no reason why you should not develop the great gifts of the spirit in your own homes. Sometimes you may get despondent and depressed and feel you are not making sufficient progress, but we help you from our side all we can, although we cannot say how long individual development will take. With some it takes years, with others it comes very quickly if they persevere. But of faith, sit in sincerity of spirit and use your gifts to serve mankind. The aftermath of war has left the world in chaos. More than ever will you be needed to transmit the help that can come from our side of life. Man's ignorance and selfishness has brought great suffering to mankind, and people ask why does God allow these things? But God gave you free will. Search to find a link with those in spirit and remember the promise of Jesus when you sit. Lo, I am with you always. Go forward in strength and know that you too will be serving. Be his servants, his children, and it will bring to you the peace which is everlasting. With these words, the first big public demonstration of the independent direct voice held in full light came to an end.